Thank you so much, Joseph. And really, all of this is just an opportunity for me to catch up with you in all of your reading over the last 12 years. There's a lot to work toward there. Thank you as well to Faye Landis, co-chair of the Education Committee, and all the members of the Education Committee. Thank you to this evening's sponsors, to Rabbi Adler, as well as always, as well as the numerous family members who are on the call as well, or on the shir as well, who can stay afterward and correct for the record any mistakes that I might have made along the way. But hopefully they will be relatively minor and hopefully will be very much on target. Over the course of this past year, I've had the opportunity to, for the last number of months, as I said, to catch up with Joseph and to really to read a substantial number of the sermons, not only to organize them on the site, but really it's a tremendous zechus that this year my Shabbos reading is to read a substantial number of the drashos that are available online on the website. And it's been an emotional journey for me on a number of levels. And I would just say to open that on the one hand, certainly certain reminiscences that emerged from the drashot that I was reading, conversations that I enjoyed with Rabbi Lam, in which he cited various sources that I then saw that he had delivered in a drasha in one of his various pulpits in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, just other conversations that we had, the Vrei Torah that he had cited, or I'd seen in other contexts, that all of a sudden there they were, and I could imagine myself in the audience being wowed and inspired, not just in a local or an individual conversation, but imagine the oration and the mastery of this presentation to this entire entire community, and the ways in which his words must have uplifted them now as he continues, even after his passing, to uplift us into the present and the future as well. At the same time, I also had the opportunity not only to recall with nostalgia some of my past experiences and learning, but also to perhaps be reintroduced to many of the ideas of Rabbi Lam. And I think that that's something that's really been an extraordinary journey for me. And I think that perhaps for anyone who's had the opportunity to read the drashos on a regular or an irregular basis, is that there's always something new, there's always something novel. And indeed, it's there that I want to start. I came in I'd seen, of course, many of the drashos, but not necessarily read them comprehensively with an eye toward building kind of a larger picture of not only his extraordinary and inspiring rhetorical style, his prose, which is really wrought as poetry, and just the extraordinary eloquence of his language, but also Rabbi Lam's the ideas, the content, and what's, I think, very well known to many of us who heard any of the sermons at any point, anyone who had that merit, those of us who have read a good number, or even just one of the sermons, because they essentially all share this quality, is certainly the wide range of sources that he had at his disposal was simply extraordinary. It was really just remarkable. You read the drashos, and he's pulling on everything from Psukim to the Midrashim to Rashi to all the Rishonim to the medieval Jewish philosophers to modern commentators to, of course, 18th and 19th century leading both Litvish and, of course, Hasidic thinkers, some of whom he heard indirectly from his own relatives who were from that Hasidic line. The Vilna Gaon and the Alter Rebbe could be quoted in the same drasha, and not for a dispute, but even sometimes for a point of agreement between the two, and very few people knew kind of this incredible range of Jewish texts, never mind updated until today, his own teachers, his own mentors, including Rav Soloveitchik and so many others as well, including many of the greatest homileticians of the previous generation. But on top of all that, and then continuing to read both classic works, scientific works as well. He was a chemist by training initially and continued to be interested in science and scientific method and just reading so broadly at that time and be able to just marshal such an incredibly eclectic range of sources. And so immediately you come into the Drashos and there's a sense in which first and foremost, just simply the sheer eclecticism, the sheer range of materials that Rabbi Lem had at his disposal that was perhaps especially well represented in the sermons. In other words, it's as opposed to maybe a traditional halacha shir where you're kind of drawing from a more narrow range of mekoros. If you're writing on Rav Chaim Volozhin and Torah Lishma, and you're writing your dissertation, which you wrote under Rav Soloveitchik, and you're publishing that as a book, so you're going to stay relatively focused even as you show your remarkable range. But the drashos really, they run the gamut. And that was my impression coming in, and that's only been reinforced. In fact, those who have access to Festivals of Faith, which is a collection, I'm sure many are familiar with Rabbi Lam's drashos on a number of the Chagim, over 60 of the sermons are collected and retyped there. Dr. David Schatz has an introduction, and he writes that simply the sheer range of material, the 300-plus mekoros that appear in those 660-some-odd sermons, there are only 18 of the sources, including just psukim and chumash, that appear more than once. There's barely any repetition. Themes themselves are manifold. So the sense of the multiplicity, the sense of that range of that eclecticism was always very clear to me. And yet at the same time, what was remarkable is to think about, well, is there any conceptual unity? Of course, there's a unity in terms of his style, in terms of his remarkable ability to connect with his audience, to understand the issues that were kind of gnawing at them and that were most pertinent and most pressing in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. But was there anything conceptually, thematically that pulled them together? I didn't know. I went in, reading every week, trying to just make my way through, first and foremost to select some drashos that perhaps would be worthwhile to share with the wider community, but as well, thinking about this question of the unity of the drashos. And I noticed along the way an insight that I'd like to share that in retrospect I probably should have realized even beforehand, which is that although it's true that Rabbi Lam certainly shows this remarkable range, and although it's also true that he didn't feel compelled to cite many, many drashos, or many, many mikoros rather, sources over the course of his drashos, if the sermon would speak for itself just from a couple of psukim or simple midrash, he had no reason to prove himself to his community, no reason to prove himself to himself either, and to somehow feel the need to start quoting from all over the place, although he always could if he chose to, but rather he knew how to just jump in and deliver a sermon simply based on the psukim alone. He does that regularly as well. So all of that certainly is true. But as I went through, I started to notice that although the range is there, there's one source, which of course I've noted in the shir title, or one author, which is the Kutzke Rebbe, who perhaps has a unique role to play. I didn't see this immediately, but I should have seen it. And the reason I should have seen it is because I remember him quoting comments from the Kutzke Rebbe all the time, Vortlach and classic pieces, and it makes sense. So many of the great darshanim of this and previous generations in particular, though Rabbi Lam would say that I know Rabbi Adler is here, so Rabbi Adler accepted, and maybe a few others. There aren't that many outstanding darshanim, perhaps, or Drush doesn't have the same stature as it once did, as Rabbi Lam famously Rude in his in one of his classic essays, in which he actually very much he offered his apologia essentially for sermonics and his faith in their continued value, and yet when he would often quote Vertlach and many others as well, many of the darshan in the previous generation, it was the Kutzker to whom they were turned. But then I said to myself, wait a second, he's quoting the Kutzker, but everyone quoted the Kutzker. That doesn't say anything particularly interesting. Is there really a standout kind of way in which the Kutzker is central to his drashos, to his ideas, in a way that perhaps other sources are important but don't quite have the same pride of place? So I went online, there's a search function. Truth is that Joseph, thank you for the kind words. We've updated a little bit, but the search functionality is still, I think, could be taken to the next level. And it's not a perfect gauge of all the content in the archives, but I thought it was worthwhile. And I did notice that aside from, I Googled a whole bunch of Mekoros, I said, Chumash and Torah and Rashi and Midrash and didn't Google, sorry, rather searched in the database itself. Ramban, Nachmanides, Maimonides, Rambam, Rosalavichika, the Alter Rebbe, you name it, all these and all the various different, the Ger Rebbe, Svasemes, and trying to use all sorts of different ways that he might have referred to them, and yet of all of those, other than Chumash and Rashi and the Midrashim, more so than Rav Soloveitchik, more so than the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chassidus, more than the Baal Shem Tov, more than the Svas Emes, the Gerer Rebbe, the Rebbe's from Vizhnitz, which is where his family was, his family background is from, more than any of those was references to the Kutzker. And it's at least 20 times, I suspect it's more, because the search does not cover all of the sermons, because some of them didn't have the same OCR or technological search functionality. So it's not a perfect science, and I suspect that there may have been a couple of more, but I thought it was pretty striking that after Chumash and Rashi and Midrash, that the Kutzker Rebbe was the highest turnout of any of them. I thought that was really interesting. But again, what does that prove? And what I'd like to suggest this evening is that, in fact, it does prove something quite substantial. And I wanted to start with a drasha, with an idea that he develops with regard to Pesach. I will share the basic outlines of the drasha, and then I'll share in a few moments a source sheet which we're going to go through and see a number of the classic instances in which Rabbi Lam, in fact, invokes the Kutzker in all sorts of pivotal ways over the course of his drashos, and try to make of that something meaningful, hopefully not only with regard to Pesach, but also in terms of the first steps toward a larger understanding of perhaps Rabbi Lam's Ovyer, and how the sermons, how the drashos themselves in particular, may highlight certain values that he saw were especially paramount, even as, of course, he saw so many values and so many texts to be incredibly significant, and yet is there perhaps a direction here in this insight into the role of the Kutzker in the drasha. So it was a drasha in 1978, he was already a president of Yeshiva University, not giving drashos on a regular basis, 1972, and he gives a drasha at the Jewish Center about the Paschal Lamb. You can find this on the website if you're interested. You can just go under the holidays, you can go under Pesach, there's probably the largest number there on Pesach, but they're organized chronologically, so it's toward the end you'll find this drasha there. And it's something interesting. He actually quotes, interestingly enough, from a family member. And he makes the point that if we take a look at the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, there's a striking element to the story that we might have otherwise missed out on or not appreciated if we didn't look especially carefully. And he points in particular to the hypocrisy of Paro and sort of the official institutions of Mitzrayim. And of course, he's alluding to, more than alluding, he refers to the charges of hypocrisy that were increasingly common, especially among young people in the mid to late 60s. And we think about the time period, the early 1970s. And so it's not a surprise that issues of hypocrisy and of authenticity and of honesty and these kinds of questions, of especially of institutional powers and government and so on and so forth, were very much central to the concerns of many of his members and many members of the larger community, larger American community as a whole. And Rabbi Lam begins by sharing the insight that there really is a significant institutional governmental hypocrisy on the part of Paro and Mitzrayim as a whole. First observation that he makes is, he says, well, you take a look at something very interesting that happens from the outset. Paro doesn't make some major announcement to the entire community or to all of Egyptian society. He takes aside the Miado. And he tells them, well, this is what we're going to do, right? If you see these Jewish children, we're going to go ahead with a particular, right? We're going to try to drown them. And why does he take these two aside, and why is there a private conversation? And there's a suggestion, and there are midrashim, he doesn't cite this, but there are midrashim that support this as well, that it wasn't widely publicized, that this is something that was kept quiet, so as to perhaps protect the institutions and the pharaoh and the public officials from the perception that they were trying to engage in something that would even begin to approximate genocide or any sort of genocidal or incredibly violent activities toward a minority population within Egypt. And then it continues, and something very interesting that happens, and the language of Paro, a little bit later on in the parak, is he says that, Kol ha-bein ha-yilod ha-yeorah tashlichuhu. V'chol habas tichayun. And the Gemara in Sota, again, he doesn't quote directly from the Gemara in Sota. He's quoting from a family member, pulling this all together. The Gemara in Sota, which is clearly the basis for this observation, on Daf Yud Beis and Aleph, in a classic Agadata, the Gemara actually makes the observation that although previously we were talking about the Jews or the Ivrim, they're completely absent here. Why? Kol habein hayilod hayora tashlichu. We should say again, habein ha'ivri. Why does he specifically omit? So you might have suggested, and some understand, that of course we're talking about Jewish children. Who else are we talking about over here? Goes without saying. That's what we were talking about previously. So of course that's who we're talking about now. We're talking about throwing the boys into the Nile River. And again, the classic Midrashic explanation, that the concern about Moshe Rabbeinu and ensuring that there's no savior of the Jewish people who was to be born. And yet the Gemara says that no, that actually he publicly said that anyone would be killed. And there are different versions or different approaches how to understand the Gemara. Some say because he was concerned that maybe there could even be a savior who would come from the Mitzrayim. That, of course, to some extent was true, given Moshe Rabbeinu's background from the palace of Paro. And yet there are others, and this is what Rabbi Lam suggests in that drasha, who say that no, that Paro was actually two-faced about it. Meaning, the public statement was, oh, take anyone, we're worried, there's some concern, there's some massive conspiracy that's underway within our kingdom, we're still figuring out what's going on, let's investigate, let's figure out what's happening over here, so what are we going to do? We're concerned for the very survival, or whether or not it's even justified to allow for, even with such a drastic measure, go ahead, and we should kill each and every one of these newborn males, and that should be what we should do. But he never publicly said what everyone understood very easily between the lines, that of course he wasn't talking about just anyone, he was talking about the Jews and only the Jews. And so Paro's public persona, or his desire to sort of hide behind a plausible alternative explanation of his own policies that was clearly duplicitous, that was clearly two-faced, became part of the hypocrisy that the Torah sought to expose over the course of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And this continues. He points out that at Kriyas Yamsuf, the emphasis, and throughout the story, very often the emphasis is not on the Mitzriim, the Egyptians per se. Although certainly there's a polemic against Mitzrayim as the Mitzriim as a nation, but it's against Mitzrayim. It's Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim. If you take a look at the text, and he suggests that again, that it's not just an attack on Mitzrayim so much as on the official policies and institutions and the hypocrisies of Egypt, that they claim that they're not engaging in this evil attempt to treat the Jews in such a brutal fashion, yet that's exactly what they do, despite hiding behind their false rhetoric and misleading rhetoric. And then he continues and he even suggests something really remarkable. I've never seen this before. There's a basic problem I'm sure many are familiar with regard to the role of the sheep, the role of the seh in the whole story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. After all, we classically, many of us perhaps grew up with the assumption that the reason that the Jews were commanded to take the seh and to tie it to their bed and to ultimately slaughter that as a Korban Pesach is because, of course, the sheep, the keves, was one of the gods of Mitzrayim. And yet we now know that, in fact, nothing could be farther from the truth. I would take a look at all the historical documents and archaeological materials and so on and so forth. There's a consensus among historians that, in fact, the Egyptians had a whole pantheon of animal gods that they worshipped, including plus Ra, the sun god, and other entities as well. And yet, irony of ironies, of all of them, the sheep is conspicuously absent. And so the whole notion that the Jews are specifically told to take the sheep and to slaughter that as a way of showing their rejection, the public rejection of the gods of Egypt, and instead their embrace of the God of Israel, the true God, that doesn't hold up to historical scrutiny. So what's going on? Why are the Jews taking the sheep? And he suggests, and of course this has been homiletically as so many of the ideas that he developed in his sermon, and which he defended in that piece that I referred to earlier in his notes of an unrepentant darshan, in which he said that homiletics has its own integrity and is a legitimate and key avenue or genre of Torah learning in its own right. And so he suggests that no, that in fact it wasn't a rejection of the gods of Egypt. The gods of Egypt, among the animals, it was actually the bull that was considered to be the highest god among the different gods of the animals of the Egyptians. And of course, the bull is the symbol of brute strength and and of brute power, as the Egyptians demonstrated throughout. And yet, although that was truthfully who Paro was, that which Mitzrayim represented, and the ways in which they interacted with the Jews, originally nice, and then Vayakamel Chadash Shelo Yadas Yosef, all of a sudden we've forgotten about them, and we're concerned about the Jews taking over, so we're going to mistreat the Jews in this way. And so the Egyptians present themselves as almost as innocent. We're not trying to hurt anyone. We're not trying to single out any particular minority or population. We're simply doing that which we need to do to make sure that our empire continues to exist and to survive. And so, in other words, they presented themselves as we might think of as the lamb. Right, so here it's not the lion and the lamb. Here it is, and again, no pun intended, given the topic of our shir. But right, and he doesn't make any jokes that others have about the shechting of the lamb. But we'll so leave that aside. There were some exchanges, and very sharp exchanges that he had in very pleasant ways, but very, very, very intelligent jokes that that rabbis sometimes make, especially brilliant rabbis. And so he had a couple of those as well over the years. But here he doesn't note the irony. He just simply points out that Mitzrayim was presenting itself as if it was the bull. And the Jews say, no, 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 we're going to offer a korban to the Keves. And that was their symbolic way of actually killing not the official, or sort of not the actual gods of Egypt, but the official public policy of the quote-unquote gods, or the persona of the Egyptians, of Mitzrayim and of Paro. And so when they slaughtered the Seh, it's almost as if they were saying, yeah, this Seh, we see you who you really are. We're going to slaughter the Seh because that's not your god officially, but that is how you represent yourselves to the world, and we're going to call you out on that, and we're going to slaughter that, and we're going to expose your hypocrisy to the entire world. And so this is the idea, and I think it's an underappreciated motif. I've never really thought about this in terms of, if you think about this in terms of Mitzrayim, so we talk about defeating the Egyptian pantheon and abandoning that and leaving the immorality and the pagan beliefs as well, polytheism of the Egyptians, and instead embracing the God of Israel and the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and Yetzias Mitzrayim, and the ways in which that informed the Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, and so on and so forth, the birth of the Jewish people, Klal Yisrael, Shir Hashirim, what have you, all of this, Parshas HaChodesh, which is upcoming, all of that we think of, but the exposure of hypocrisy, of official public hypocrisy, completely new, incredibly novel, brilliant, really ingenious, and it's really worthwhile as we begin to prepare for the start in this year is to really think about, wow, that's a very different kind of perspective. What might that mean for the Seder night? What might that mean for the larger set of narratives of Yetzias Mitzrayim? That in of itself was striking and really quite remarkable. But perhaps even more remarkable and telling, I think, is at the end. And here, hopefully everyone can see my the source sheet that we have over here. He concluded with the following words. And he said, I don't want to say, he also wrote on Motzei Shabbos, but he also said as follows, that in that Rasha, as delivered on Shabbos HaGadol, it is good to remember, this is the closing, it is good to remember the words of the Rabbi of Kutsk, the Kutzker Rebbe. At this point, by the way, he's presumably even assuming that his crowd at the Jewish Center know who that is, even though in previous drashos he had actually, you know, introduced him. But now they know who the Rabbi of Kutsk is. It may not be in every man's power to find the truth, but it is certainly within his power to reject lies, cheating, and hypocrisy. And of course, this is renowned, at least in the popular homiletical imagination, as one of the central themes or motifs of the Kutzker himself. The truth is, we have very little, we really essentially have nothing that remains from the Kutzker's own words or writings, but certainly the way in which he's been received by Darshanim over the generations is especially for this concern of the rejection of hypocrisy, of a commitment to emes above all else. And it's that theme that Rabbi Lem was really identifying with regard to this story of Mitzrayim, and it was that citation with which he concluded that Shabbos HaGadol drasha in 1972. And I think it's really striking, and I saw this, and I started to wonder, wow, that's a really powerful way to end, and also there's this familiarity, oh, it's the Rabbi of Kutsk. What was his community already familiar with the Kutzker? Perhaps he assumed that they knew who the Kutzker was without saying it, but its truth is, it got me wondering. And so I did the search and find all these times. And all of a sudden, I started to realize that, in fact, the Kutzker figures quite prominently. In some ways, it has nothing to do with the theme of hypocrisy at all. And what I'd like to do for the remainder of our time is to explore a number of different instances in which Rabbi Lam relied specifically on the Kutzker in all sorts of significant ways. And first of all, just some that I happen to know, and I've heard from him as well, that I knew were particularly beloved to him. And he cited numerous times, not just in his drashos, but in other contexts as well, including Nechagas Micha drasha and other major rabbinic addresses as well. And that's number two. It appears among other places in 1962 sermon in the Days of Smallness. And it's one of my favorites as a mechanech. And he says as follows: the rabbi of Kutzk asked, why in this Shema do we read in these words, shall be on your heart? Why do we say alat levavecha, on your heart, and not bilvavecha, in your heart? Doesn't make sense. We're trying to instill the words of Torah within the hearts of our children, our students by extension. Right? We're not placing it on top of the heart. We want it to penetrate. We want it to go in. It should be in your heart. The rabbi of Kutzk answers, it is not too often that the heart is open and that the words of God can enter directly into it. Usually the heart is closed, indifferent, and even callous. Yet the Torah demands that if the words of the Lord cannot come right into an open heart, then at least they shall be placed on the closed heart, so that during those moments of greatness and inspiration, when the human heart suddenly opens up, then the words of Torah, which had been piled on it, will tumble in and fill the heart with the seeds of true greatness and sublimity. We're always trying to share Divrei Torah. We all have messages for others, whether it be for students, for family members, for friends, whomever it might be. And it doesn't always get across. And just because our messages, especially to those who are younger or more impressionable, don't immediately strike a receptive chord, said the Kutzker and said Rabbi Lam, it doesn't mean that they're not listening. It doesn't mean that at the right moment, it's all going to come tumbling in. And I heard him share this with me, I've heard him share this on at least a half a dozen occasions. It was, I think, particularly beloved to, I can see why. It's just so powerful, so beautiful. And here it is. And again, another instance in which he's citing the Kutzker in, and I think it here is really striking in the sense that it was an idea that was particularly beloved if the number of times in which he cited a particular drasha, especially given the wide range and the ways, as Dr. Schatz mentioned, that he doesn't regularly, quote unquote, repeat himself, it was particularly striking, I think, that to take this example. But then I think we can go further, and I started to look into this more, and I said, wait a second, how do we really judge? How do we measure what is a particularly sensual source in someone's canon? And that could be true for any subject, and really that could be true in a Torah context or in a general context. How do we know, other than just sheer quantity? Nowadays we can do searches for lots of things, so we can find raw data. It's relatively easy very often to find, well, how many times did someone either quote something, especially nowadays with the technologies that we have, especially someone who lived relatively recently, especially someone like Rabbi Lam, who was so copious in the ways in which he took notes on himself. I mean, he literally would sit down every Motzei Shabbos after he delivered a drasha and relatively uninterrupted would simply essentially transcribe himself so that he would have it, and so that perhaps so that also we would have it, l'dorei doros. So certainly, it's relatively easy, at least in some circumstances, to measure numbers, take sheer quantity in terms of the data. But how do we measure the qualitative weight? How do we measure the centrality or significance that a particular source has in the canon of a great thinker? That's, I think, a fascinating question. I don't think that there's an objective or clear-cut answer to that. But I do think that there are some measures that are worth considering. And I'd like to mention a few, and I think that they pass Rabbi Lam's drashos very much past the past the Kutzker test, as it were, in terms of its centrality as measured in a number of ways. So first of all, in addition to just the fact that he would quote something regularly and was fond of it, I think also the context in which he would quote it. If it's a particularly important context, right? If it's Yomim no Ra'im, if it's a made in drasha in a new pulpit, something like that. So a rabbi who gets up and has something to say, especially someone with so much to say and is going to share a particular idea at a key or transitional or pivotal moment or juncture in his own career or over the course of the Jewish calendar, that probably is a significant measure in terms of the importance, in terms of how prominent a particular work or individual was, as it were, on the speaker's bookshelf. Strikingly, in his very first, at least, recorded sermon, it looks like it was an introductory sermon, it's actually very clear, from 1954. This is back in Springfield, Massachusetts. And this is an self-introduction, essentially, an introductory talk. It wasn't even delivered on Shabbos morning, but it was delivered on a Shabbos, and he took the notes, I assume, afterward as well. And it's untitled. Many of the earliest Rashos from the early 50s in particular go untitled. And he concluded rather that drasha as follows. And he was talking about the tension. He said, as I become your Rav, there's a tension. There needs to be sort of a certain symbiosis or a sense of connection. There needs to be a way in which we can genuinely relate to one another. There's a certain level of comfort, of sharing and experiences together. And yet at the same time, a Rav needs to sometimes distance himself and cannot simply be just one member of the congregation. How do we strike that balance, and how do we properly navigate? How does a Rav navigate that tension? That was the theme of that talk. And so he said to his fledgling community in Springfield, he concluded that talk as follows. And he said, the famed Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kutz, right? So here, it's not something he's introduced beforehand to this community for very obvious reasons. So he said, it's the famed Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kutz. And what's striking is also it's very uncommon for him to introduce any thinker with some sort of appellation. It happened from time to time. He says in one place that the Abarbanel had a unique psychological acuity and insight. I've never heard that before, or noticed that before, and that was something that he noticed about the Abarbanel and a couple of others as well, but with the Kutzker on a fairly regular basis. When he quotes the Kutzker, it's with an additional descriptor, with some sort of appellation. And I think that's telling as well, as yet another measure. It says, the famed Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kutz once expressed this idea, right, this tension, this balance in a novel Hasidic interpretation of a Talmudic statement. Rabbis quote God as saying, Shlomo b'ni chachamu shetikin iruvinu netilas yadayim. My son Solomon is a wise man, for he instituted the iruvin, the washing of hands before meals. It was King Solomon who first gave the law of Eruvin, a symbolic act of the Takana of Eruvin. He doesn't mean the prohibition of carrying, but the actual real Eruv in a technical sense, when we talk about sharing the food and the rabbinic requirement of creating a single unified reshus, a symbolic act by virtue of which it is possible for two neighbors living in one large house to carry from one apartment to another on the Sabbath. Right? Again, this is not about a wire. This is about the food and the matzah that are shared together. It says the rite represents a common sharing of partnership between two parties. The word itself, Eruv, comes from the word meaning, to mix, to be connected with. And then Tilas Yadayim is the traditional washing of the hands before the meal. These two, says the Kutzker, says the Kutzker rabbi, are symbolic of that which we spoke. The real Solomon, the wise leader of his people, is one who knows that there are times when he must perform the Eruv, mix and mingle and share with his people, share their joys and sorrows, their laughter and their tears. And there are times that he must be able to perform Netilas Yadayim, to wash his hands in the colloquial sense, to wash his hands of the everyday community affairs, to retreat into himself, to privately build his mind and heart and soul. The true and wise leader must have something of both types. Concludes his, again, the maiden talk to his community in Springfield with this. And again, I think it's very telling. And not only did he introduce himself to a new community by clinching a drasha with the Kutzker, but on two consecutive years on Rosh Hashanah, he pulled the Kutzker out to give two incredibly powerful sermons back to back, as it were, 1969 and 1970. And here we're back to the future, to the Jewish Center. And this is, I think, one of the most psychologically remarkable ones among the drashas that I've seen. It's been published, I think, in a couple of places as well. I think it's in Drashos Lederos and in other contexts as well. The Greatest Trial. And he asked the question, and the Kutzker asked the question. He says, what exactly is going on? The pasuk says that after Avraham Avinu performed the Akedah, it says the word Atah. All right, that the Malach says Atah Yadati Ki Re Elokim Atah. Now I know. Right? Until now, Avraham, right, he was a nobody. All of a sudden now that you were willing to do this, right, I know that you are a great person. And more than that, right, the Malach doesn't say so after he was willing to take his son up onto the mountain, leave the other two behind him, go all the way up, take this journey, pull out the knife, right, and say, oh, don't worry about it, Yitzchak, right? Hashem will show us what will be. Pull out the knife and about to engage in this sacrifice, right? It was only after he stopped. It's only after he stopped that the Malach says, ah, Ataya Dati. So he said like this. In the story of the Akedah, we read that after the angel of the Lord had stayed the hand of Abraham, and Isaac was released from his bonds on the altar, the angel declared at that time, now I know that you are a God-fearing man. Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kutsk, one of the most profound, again, this is this unique descriptor that he assigns the Kutsk, one of the most profound and mysterious of the Polish Hasidic leaders, asks, why the emphasis on Ata now? If the binding of Isaac on the Akedah was the act of sacrifice that marked Avraham as a Yirei Elokim, then the statement Ata Yadati should have come earlier in the narrative when Avraham bound his son. Is it not out of place now that Isaac was saved, right? So the timing of the Malach is all wrong. The answer of the Kutzker is nothing short of amazing, even shocking. It says that for Abraham to take Isaac off the altar was many times harder than for him to offer him up in the first place. That's stunning, right? For him to take him off the altar, his son off the altar, was even more difficult than for him to offer him up in the first place. That's shocking words. It was more painful for Abraham to release Isaac than it was to bind him. And that is why the angel said, Ataya Dati, first now do I know that you are really, really a Yirei Elokim. What can the Kutzker Rebbe mean by this? Certainly not that Abraham had any special pleasure in sacrificing Isaac. To cast Abraham in the role of an idealistic sadist or masochist is to misread and undo the entire meaning of the Akedah. Rather, the Kutzker here presents us with a new interpretation of the Akedah, one which teaches an awesome psycho-spiritual insight. It is the nature of man, once he has taken a clear position in life, especially if he has suffered for it, not to retreat from it, but to mold the future along the doctrines of the past in order to vindicate his past. It is part of our normal psychology. What we have invested in time, in energy, loyalty, and commitment, prestige, and reputation in a certain approach, we do not want to change. We cannot change lest we thereby declare that our entire past has been invalid, and inauthentic self-justification of our past dictates our future. And said the Kutzker, and Rabbi Lam said then to his community, this is the message of the Akedah, or a message of the Akedah for Rosh Hashanah. Not to make tremendous sacrifices, that is a tremendous thing. But to live our lives with a certain mindset, with a certain approach year in, year out, and to then radically pivot once we've made all sorts of excuses and explanations, not to others only, but even for ourselves, and then to walk it all back, to acknowledge that it was all wrong and it was all a misreading of not just what God wanted, but what was right and what truly represented the right direction for me, of course, because it was not the true direction, the authentic direction that God wanted from me. That perhaps is the most difficult trial of all, the greatest trial. And so he urges his community, the height of his sermon on Rosh Hashanah, to follow the Kutzker's message and to be willing to acknowledge that perhaps so many of the assumptions that we've taken for granted and so many of the defense mechanisms that we've put in place really maybe are wrong. You want to know, are you real Yirei Elokim? Ata Yadati Ki Yirei Elokim Ata? That's the moment when we're willing to not justify ourselves, but to walk back literally our entire lives. That's the greatest moment. That's the greatest trial, and that which Yitzchak represented. Truly remarkable. 1 year later, this one's, interestingly enough, 1970 and yet entitled, still from Rosh Hashanah. But once again, the Kutzker figures prominently, and this he closes yet another Rosh Hashanah. Again, it wasn't back-to-back 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, but it's back-to-back in years. Hopefully that's enough for qualifying as a back-to-back, if not titles, then Kutzkers. And he said as follows. He said, I close with a brilliant and incisive comment. Again, those compliments by Rabbi Nachman Mendel of Kutsk. And those, by the way, who've spoken with Rabbi Lam about Drashos. If you go to him and ask him for feedback and he was being honest, he wouldn't immediately just say, "Oh, that was fantastic. That was great." He would give compliments, but he could, you know, he really understood how to discern, you know, high quality sermonics or drashos or divrei Torah. And he wasn't uncomfortable saying so, always with respect and always with a smile, but nonetheless. This is right, as my mother always told me growing up, it's true that not everyone has to say something mean, but right, they didn't have to say anything at all. That can be very telling. He didn't have to say anything, he just quoted the Kutzker. But again, time and time again, he chooses to say something particularly kind. I think it's telling. Goes to the brilliant and incisive comment by Reb Menachem Mendel of Kutzk. The Talmud says, "Piskli Pesach kip chuda shel machad v'ani yeftach lochem kifischo shel ulam. If you open, will open to me the size of a needle prick. I will open to you like the great doors of a giant hall," said the Kutzker. That is true. All God demands of us is the opening the size of the head of a needle. But it must be dersh on dersh, through and through. It is not sufficient merely to prick the surface of life, but we must go through and through to the very depth, beyond the Pesach Hachitzon, to the Delas Lifnim Mi Delas. Says the Kutzker, it's true. All we need is a small opening from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. I've talked about the lave before, right? The lave is often closed, the Kutzker pointed out. But yet, that's not the goal of life. It has to be truly penetrating. That's right. Again, this is consistent. It's not exactly the idea of MS, but it's not unrelated. That idea of true authenticity, that if we're doing something, it needs to be done whole, it needs to be done completely. And it's not enough to give ourselves some sort of pat on the back for sort of a comfortable approach to Judaism and to religious living. No, we need to step up to choose something that's important to us and not just to do it half-heartedly, not just to do it halfway. We have to go through and through. And so that was the message of that particular year. Again, the maiden drasha in Kehila Kadima in his community in Springfield, two consecutive years on Rosh Hashanah, I think it's telling as well. I think that there's a third, yet another measure for how we might be able to infer the role of a thinker in the Oviur and in the canon of a great thinker. Such as Rabbi Lam, and that is not just whether or not he regularly cited someone, not just that he cited that individual on particularly important occasions, but also the way in which you use a thinker. You can just quote someone as kind of part of a litany of different makoros, right? And quote a Gemara, and then I can quote, and go to a Pasuk, and then I have a Midrash, and then I have a Rashi, and then I have a Ramban, and then I have a Chassidish of Vart, and I can quote all of that. And if each one is just sort of, you know, hanging there, is not particularly central to the drasha, so then it's an important source, it's there, it's significant, it made it for a reason, it made the final cut. Harlem used to say that he would censor himself. He said he would write his drasha, and he would tell rabbis, they would ask him, you know, Rabbi Lam, the first-rate darshan, arguably, of the 20th century, right? He would, of course, have insisted that it was Rav Soloveitchik, because the Rav was the greatest darshan of the 20th century, but certainly, right there, top tier, at the final list, and people would ask him, you know, what do you recommend? Or you talk to smicha students, and he would say, one of the things he would always say is that you have to, you write, there's the drasha, he would say that, a couple of things, he would say there's the drasha that you should have delivered, the drasha you actually did deliver, the drasha you wanted to deliver, the drasha you did deliver, and then the drasha that you should have delivered. That was one thing that he would always say. Another thing he would say is that the is that he would write his drashos extensively and have all sorts of ideas, and he would write and he would overwrite, and you know, back then he could actually go on for like 25 minutes or a drasha, right? It was remarkable, but then he would censor and edit himself and cross out, X out half the drasha. He would say, is this essential? Is that essential? Does it have to stay? If you can't say it's absolutely essential, cut it. Right, get rid of it. And this is what he told students who would ask him, well, how should I go about writing his drasha? How he had 25 minutes of such brilliance by the time he was done cutting out half of his material is well beyond me. But of course, he was able to do that. But I think it's very telling, because anything that remains, that stayed in the drasha, and that was really, I think, something he thought could not be cut out and made the final cut. And so if it was there, it was there for a reason. And it's interesting, because I would suggest that in addition to simply appearing in a sermon, if a Dvar Torah or a thinker appears either A, at the very beginning of the sermon, be as the clincher, as the very end of the drasha, and C, I would suggest, above all, as the kind of the central axis around which the entire drasha revolves, that I think is particularly telling. You're not just quoting a thinker among others, you're opening with him or her. You are closing. You are building an entire idea around a particular thinker, in this case around the Kutzker. I think that would be particularly telling as well. So I looked at that, and lo and behold, probably not surprisingly at this point, but again, in remarkable fashion, you see this as well in some really, really interesting contexts. One is the Shield of Abraham. This is one that you can take a look at. I'm not going to read it inside, but essentially he opens the drasha with the Kutzker. He's talking about Magin Avraham. Why do we say Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? And then we end Magin Avraham, and the Gemara says, Chazal say, Bechachosmen. That we conclude by referring to Avram. And so the Kutzker said, why? Because each of the Avos represent a different central principle of Avodas Hashem. And so you have Chesed, and you have Avoda, and you have Torah, etc. Chesed or Gemilas Chasadim, right? Based on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, toward the very beginning. And the Kutzker says, V'chachosmen, that shows that in the end, the most paramount feature or characteristic of Yahadus ultimately is Gemilos Chasadim, and therefore that's what the Gemara wants to say. B'chachosmen that Gemilos Chasadim. That's why we conclude with the bracha of Magen Avraham. Now Rabbi Lam doesn't stop there. He actually goes a step further than the Kutzker, and he quotes the Kutzker not to simply apply his idea, but to build on his idea. He actually goes on to say that that perhaps we can even suggest further that B'chachosmen teaches us that Gemilos Chasadim is not only paramount among the three, arguably, he says, but that actually even Avoda and even Talmud Torah and even Gemilas Chasadim itself can be performed in a way that is self-centered or is that focused on giving as well. And so Gemilas Chasadim, because not only especially important, but becomes, so we talk about, the Gemara talks about and took about Torah Shel Chesed and so on and so forth, that becomes the measure or the key characteristic, the shade that we're looking for in each and every one of these areas of Avodas Hashem, even in terms of Gemilas Chasadim, the difference between simply throwing a kopek at someone as opposed to genuinely opening up our heart to the needs of another and giving in that way. And so here again, it's not so much that he's quoting the Kutzker as the central idea, but he opens with the Kutzker and uses that as his starting point for the rest of the drasha. In terms of the ending, I'm not going to go over new ones in that context, but I would just point to two that we've already seen. The one in Kadima, as we saw, the one about the Eruv and Tilas Yodayim, that was the closing of his drasha. So it wasn't just that it was the opening, it wasn't just a particularly prominent moment in terms of his introduction to the community, but as we saw, that was the clincher. That's how he brought it home. And he never finished drashos by simply saying, Bimhira v'yameinu, amen. Even when he was essentially saying, Bimhira v'yameinu, amen, he was saying, right, he was saying it in a way that would maintain the interest and engagement of his kehila all the way through. That was how he paskened on that central debate among darshanim. There's no chiyuv to say the words Bimhira v'yameinu, amen at the very end of a drasha. But even when he wouldn't, lo aleinu rachman letzlan, conclude his drasha by referring to Bimhira v'yameinu, again, on a number of occasions, he would close specifically with the Kutzker. So the one in Kadima, Erev and Tias Adayim, that was the clincher, that was the end, the one that we just saw in source number 5, that's from Rosh Hashanah, that was at the very end, that was the clincher, Lifnimidelis, it has to go through and through. So you have the beginning of the drasha, you have the end of the drasha, you have the bookends, but as well, you have sort of the central axis around which the entire drasha revolves. And this is true in one sermon that we've already seen, The Greatest Trial, right? The one from 1969, in which he talks about how Avram's greatest challenge was to reverse course and to acknowledge that everything he had invested into this radical act of sacrificial act, it was just all wrong. Right? That is the greatest trial, and that becomes the energy, that becomes the pivot, that becomes really the essence of his entire message, and everything else, every other part of that drasha is really an unpacking of that idea from the Kutzker. But he did this time and time again when he quoted Rav Menachem Mendel of Kutsk, 1974, Too Wise, Too Foolish. He's talking about Korach, and he wants to know What exactly was wrong with Korach? And the Kutzker Rebbe said as follows. You look on the second line over here, but the Kutzker Rebbe adds two or three words to the quotation that Rashi cites about Korach. What motivated Korach? Mara lishtus zo. He was a pikeach. He was a smart guy. So to Rashi's words, third line, he adds lihios pikeach. How did Korach, such a clever man, get involved in the foolishness of being clever? What does that mean? Smart man, the foolishness of being clever. And so the Kutzker goes on to say, because, and this is a classic Kutzkerism and others as well, yeah, that's exactly right. It's possible to be too smart, to outsmart even ourselves. Rav Kook also has a remarkable piece, actually, in context of his discussion of vegetarianism. And he says something very similar. He talks about, in terms of animal rights, and then we can come up with all sorts of philosophical arguments. At the end of the day, if it's blinding us to our natural instinctive sense, but intellectual also, sense of what's right and what's good and what's yashar, we can outsmart ourselves at times, says Rav Kook. And so Rabbi Lam says exactly the same idea here as well, that there are times when we can kind of move away from our natural instinct. And this I won't go into, but I do think that the idea of natural piety, natural morality, seeing halacha as essential, as the foundation for everything. But Rabbi Lam was insistent time and time again that halacha is a baseline, but it is not the be-all and end-all. It is not the entirety of morality that Yahadus wants us to strive for. It is the starting point, and then we need to build from there. Obviously, many ideals are embedded in the halachic system, but they may need not all be embedded in the halachic system. We have Drush, we have Midrash, we have all sorts of other chassidus, etc., sources of piety, and even our own instinctive sense. He was inclined toward the view in an article that he published in 1979, in the first law journal, I think, of that Cardozo published, together with Professor Aaron Kirschenbaum. He takes on the issue of natural law, natural morality. Is everything encompassed by the Torah, or can our instincts kind of guide us to that which is right? And he's more inclined, at least there, to that view. So he goes on to say here that that it's possible to even outsmart ourselves. And I think that that's part of this idea. And again, this is not just a nice word that he says, but this is the essence of his drasha. And I'm not going to read it now just because of time considerations, but if anyone's interested, I'm sure we can get the source sheet, or you can certainly feel free to be in touch with me as well after the shir. Otherwise, I'm happy to share my contact information for the source sheet, which, again, I'm happy to share. If you take a look, there are a couple of other contexts in which he does this as well. But I want to really turn now to one that I think is really a pivotal one. And I think begins to take us toward a deeper understanding of the role of the Kutzker in Rabbi Lam's thinking. It takes us back ultimately as well to that teaching, to that drasha from Pesach as well. We mentioned earlier the theme of hypocrisy. Right? And I think that one of the reasons that Rabbi Lam, I suspect, was so drawn to the Kutzker is not just because his Vertlach were so sharp and incisive, which very much fit Rabbi Lam's personality and his style, and the sermonic style as well, not just because the Kutzker, like Rabbi Lam himself, kind of bridged the worlds, was almost like one of the most litvish of Hasidic Sherevas that ever lived. And there's a certain truth to that, especially in terms of that emes point, and that element of it. But also, to come to that, this sense of authenticity, this sense of an allergy to hypocrisy, the sense of being truthful in terms of who we are and not misrepresenting ourselves, is true not only in terms of how he lived his own life, but I think was something that he saw, this commitment to emes, is really central to Yahadus itself. And so here he says in 1962, his drasha right there at the beginning of Parshas Bereishis. And so he says as follows. He says, how appropriate is the definition offered by the rabbi of Kutsk of the Yiddish expression, mat tzaddik and peltz, a righteous person in a fur coat. And this is an image that he came back to, Rabbi Lam, on a few occasions. This is the sarcastic title characterizing one who is only pseudo pious. Right, and here we have the Kutzker, because we're talking about, of course, pseudo-piousness. The Kutzker Rebbe says, there are two kinds of tzaddikim or pious persons. These are equivalent to the two ways of keeping warm. One type of person, when he wishes to keep warm, builds a fire. The other kind puts on a fur coat of pelts. The one who builds a fire is himself warm, and he succeeds in warming others as well. But the man who merely covers himself with his pelts, he reserves warmth for himself. He denies it to others. So there is a tzaddik whose piety can benefit many people, but it is an inferior type of tzaddik who selfishly hoards his religiosity. He is a tzaddik in a pelts. So it is with those who are satisfied that they and their children study Torah and observe Jewish law, refuse to participate in those communal agencies which try to ensure the emanation and dissemination of Torah throughout the Jewish community. They are tzaddikim in little fur coats, forever ignoring the frigid atmosphere in which their neighbors must thrive. They are not really tov godin, tov el Torah. True Torah, true Jewishness, true Judaism requires creative goodness, outgoing goodness, a superabundance of goodness that is a service for others as well. It is true of people as it was of the old railroad tickets upon which was printed the words, no good if detached. No good if detached. That is a keeper as well. That's just... I don't even need to give a shir and just like sit here and like read. And if especially if you've heard him speak, you can ignore my voice and perhaps the perorations can stay with you. But it speaks for itself. But what's striking here is not just the commitment to a Torah of Chesed, as we said earlier, the Gemilas Chasodim theme, but that there is a sense in which piety that is only reserved for myself is not even in itself true piety. It's pseudo piety. It's not really authentic. It's not emistic in that way. And again, I'm happy to share, but there are many, many, many other contexts in which he made this point. I'm going to skip over a little bit. I'll just point out, but if anyone's interested, in Shlachi 1955, he says, why are the Meraglim punished so harshly after all they spoke truthfully? They never lied. He says, there's a difference between not lying, said the Kutzker, and telling the MS. He says, I can say something that's not false, but that doesn't mean it's true. Truth is more than avoiding falsehood. It is giving a genuinely comprehensive and accurate portrayal of the situation, particularly as seen through the lens of God. In other words, if God sends me on a mission to Israel to report back, not to consider the fact that, yes, that we were like chagavim, we were like grasshoppers in their eyes, and yet not to see the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us the capacity to conquer and to earn this land that Zavas Chalav Udvash, in which there are such massive fruit, and that's a gift, rather than a reason to throw up our hands and to engage in yeush and just to simply give up hope and despond to engage in despondency. So he says that's not just wrong. He says that's not MS. He says what the Meraglim did wrong is that they stated facts, but they did not represent the larger truth. And again, it's not just enough to be accurate, MS, as an overarching value as well, and that he has here as well. And he talks about this idea, dignity comes from oneself. He kind of talked about that in context of Yom HaTzma'ud in 1960. The Mishnah Pirkei Avos, of which he was very fond of Pirkei Avos, of many, many shiurim over the years, and talks about Tiferes Le'oseha, V'Tiferes Lo'min Ha'adam, that there's a value, of course, in others respecting me, but there's also a value in the sense of inner dignity and being truthful. Again, Tiferes Le'oseha, that it gives me intrinsic dignity, that which I do is in fact authentic and consistent with my own system of values. There are a few more I'm going to go over for time limitations, but a sermon for the sensitive, if you want to jot it down and come back. And he talks about the idea that of the Kutzker, that we cannot be super sensitive in terms of when others give us feedback, because otherwise we won't be willing to accept the truth. He says that, he quotes the Kutzker on Shavuos in 1970, in the name of the Great Kutzker Rebbe. That's a great one. The Great Kutzker Rebbe. It's like completely unnecessary. That's just totally gratuitous. That's my mother's gratuitous compliment. I said the Great Kutzker Rebbe, like, you know, as opposed to the other Kutzker Rebbe. Right? So here he says that he says again this idea of intelligence and crookedness and corrupt ends in that. it's not enough to have just one thing. You need to put these, the entire package together, including MS, but also Gemilas Chasodim, righteousness, cleverness, goodness. It says only when it's holistic, then you have a good Jew. And you have the whole Jew. It says Das is a Yid. When you combine those virtues, these virtues of goodness and cleverness and piety, then you have the whole Jew. And that's why moral people need the Torah, because it allows us to put together the full package. And not surprisingly, again, here too, he closed his drasha in this way. My favorite, and this is the last one from the drushos, that I'll mention, is keep thyself far from an inoperative statement, 1974, so shortly after the Watergate scandal. And this is a great one. He talked about politicians and truth-telling, all right, which many might say don't belong in the same sentence. And he said as follows: in Washington of the Watergate era, a new term has been invented for a lie. It was first propagated by the press secretary of the president when, instead of saying that he had earlier lied, said interestingly that his previous statement was, quote, inoperative. One can imagine a new English translation of the Torah, according to the authorized version of Ron Ziegler, the person he was referring to at that time, keep thyself far from an inoperative statement, as a translation, of course, of Midvar Sheker Tirchak, right? It's like, right, here it's not just a vor, right? Here it's just, right, it's a pet peeve at this point. And that's very much, I think, the idea, right? And, of course, if you were giving drushos when people didn't inhale or other more recent events, I'm sure he would have had much the same to say. And it wasn't just in his drushos, but he again came back to the Kutzker and to the imagery of the tzaddik in pelts, in 1997, in a talk to Orthodox Jewish leaders, and talked about the value, as he did in some of his other drashos, of tocho kivoro, which is the Gemara's way, essentially, in Yuma, of saying the inside and the outside have to be much the same. And this is just a remarkable example, and then we'll close. He says, the Kutzker Rebbe explains, the spies were princes of the tribes of Israel, again, talking on Parsha about Parsha Shlach, distinguished individuals dressed undoubtedly in first Steinlach and handsome bekishes and white stockings, etc. Right? This is not exactly the tzaddik in pelts, but it's similar, right? They're all dressed up. They have the whole frum look to them, the full regalia of demonstratively frum people. Yet they inwardly had no faith in God's word. They spoke ill of Eretz Yisrael. They created havoc among their people. So Joshua and Caleb said, in that case, who needs the pretentiously religious garb? Right, so why kar ubig deham? Why is it that after the report they ripped their clothing, and so they therefore ripped the ostentatious attire off the backs of the 10 traitors, the 10 who were of those who spied the land? The verse thus reads: Joshua and Caleb, comma, right? Yeshua and Kalev, comma, tore off the clothing. Not they tore off their own clothing, he says, but they tore off the clothing of the other 10 spies, off those who spied the land. The two who were loyal in the Kutzker in his day were too devoted to emes to tolerate fashionable hypocrisy. For Rabbi Lam, this is not the certainly far from the only value of Yahados, but I would suggest that it is a principle which runs throughout the drashos. It's a principle that certainly, I think, was especially important to him. But more than that, as we've seen, and also, if anyone has the Haggadah, take a look. I'll throw it out there. Toward the very beginning, in his commentary on the Ka'ara, he talks about the view that we're not allowed to use a tzli esh. We cannot even have nowadays any sort of tzli esh of a roasted piece of meat on the Seder table, according to one view. And why not? Because the concerns are getting confused with the Korban Pesach, what's going on. He suggests again that if we misrepresent something as fundamental as the Korban Pesach, we misrepresent the difference between a zecher to a korban and the korban itself. That is not authentic. That is not truthful. That sort of hypocrisy is the very worst way that we could present ourselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to our family, and to others on the night of the Seder, on the holiday of Pesach. And I would close by suggesting that for Rabbi Lam, again, this is true not just of Yahados in general, but this is particularly true of the story of Paro. And so Pesach gives us an opportunity, I think in particular, to reflect on this overarching theme in Rabbi Lam's thought, to stay away from inoperative statements and to focus on the internals and not the externals, and true religiosity, which need not be outwardly demonstrative, and ultimately sometimes was even misrepresented in that way by the paros and by the institutional mitzrayims of the world. I wish everyone a good evening, a Shavua Tov, as well as, if it's not too early, not scaring everyone, a chag kasher v'sameach as well. Thank you so much. Happy to stay on.
Thank you, Tzvi, very much. This was really wonderful. There's one question in the chat, and due to the lateness of the hour, maybe we'll just take that.